I say unto you that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, ye shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, Thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother Raca shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say Thou fool shall be in danger of hell fire. Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there rememberest that thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar, and go thy way. First be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift. Agree with thine adversary quickly, whilst thou art in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou be cast into prison. Verily I say unto thee, thou shalt by no means come out thence till thou hast paid the uttermost farthing. Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, Thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you, that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. If thy right eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee, for it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. If thy right hand offend thee, cut it off and cast it from thee, for it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. It hath been said, Whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement. But I say unto you, that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causeth her to commit adultery, and whosoever shall marry her that is divorced committeth adultery. We come back now this morning, brethren, to look at the verse 20 there of Matthew chapter 5. Matthew 5 and verse 20. I say unto you, says Jesus Christ, that except your righteousness exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, ye shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. Now here at the outset of his public ministry, Jesus emphatically rejects the suggestion that he had come to do away with the law of God and the entire Old Testament scripture. Now what Jesus actually declares there in verse 17 of this fifth chapter of Matthew, he says, Think not, or in other words, do not think that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. He says, I am not come to destroy, but rather to fulfill. And by those words, Jesus made it plain that he had no intention of doing away with or setting aside any part of the law that God had delivered to Moses on Mount Sinai. He did not come to set aside the ceremonial law, nor the judicial law, and certainly not the moral law of God. Nor was it his purpose to set aside anything that had been prophesied in the Old Testament scriptures. In fact, notwithstanding what some had surmised and what had been rumoured about Jesus and his ministry, in fact, the truth was the very opposite. He had come, in fact, to fulfil all that was required in the law and the prophets concerning him. He was the obedient servant of Jehovah. He'd come to do the will of God and to fulfil the will of God concerning himself. Indeed, Jesus' regard for the law of God was such that even those things that others had judged to be of least significance in that law, he actually vowed to uphold and fulfill. You notice that in verse 18 when he says, For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle, the smallest aspects of the written word, one jot or one tittle, shall in no wise pass from the law, he says, till all be fulfilled. Obedience to the law of God was an integral and indispensable part of the work of Jesus Christ. Not that he viewed obedience to the law of God as a way by which men might earn their salvation, but as a way in which men might give expression to their love and devotion and thankfulness to God. Hence the warning and encouragement contained in verse 19 of this same chapter, where he says, "Whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments and shall teach men so, he shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven." Having made those things plain, now Jesus goes on in our text to make what would have been a startling statement. It would be startling because in this statement, he contrasts the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees with another righteousness. Another righteousness without which one could not enter into the kingdom of heaven. "For I say unto you that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, ye shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven." Now, a righteousness that exceeded the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees was an almost inconceivable thing in the mind of many of the Jews. After all, the Jews could hardly conceive of a righteousness that equated to the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, let alone a righteousness that exceeded or excelled the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. The truth was that in the eyes of many Jews, the scribes and the Pharisees had scaled the very pinnacle of personal piety, reaching heights of righteousness that the ordinary Jew could not possibly hope to attain unto. So therefore, for Jesus to suggest that the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees would not result in them having a place in the kingdom of heaven was radical. If the scribes and the Pharisees were not to have a place in the kingdom of heaven, the question that would have arisen in the minds of the Jews was, well, who would? And in fact, it would have also raised the question in their minds, was there a place in the kingdom for them? And so Jesus' words here would have struck home to his audience. Brethren, what we need to take from this passage of the Word of God is this: your righteousness, my righteousness, must exceed that of the scribes and the Pharisees. Because if it doesn't, if our righteousness is of the same ilk as that of the scribes and the Pharisees, there will be no place in the kingdom of heaven for any of us. And so I've titled the message this morning, "The Righteousness We Must Have." The righteousness we must have. Divided the sermon under these three headings: its essence, secondly, its source, and finally, its necessity. The words of our text were not directed solely to Jesus' disciples, but they're actually directed to the audience or the entire body of people that were actually at that time waiting upon his ministry. But what did Jesus mean then when he referenced the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees? "Except your righteousness shall exceed," he says, "the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees." But what was this righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees? By the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, Jesus was referring to the scribes and Pharisees' outward and formal obedience to the law of God. The righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees consisted in their apparent compliance and obedience to the law of God. You see, the scribes and the Pharisees were known for their scrupulous offering of the sacrifices required by the ceremonial law. They were known also for their regular fasting. They were also known for the fact that they prayed often, They're also known as being punctilious as regards the tithings that they offered to the Lord. Indeed, they were those who very, very carefully kept every aspect and every requirement of the ceremonial law, and indeed more. And yet Jesus declares to his hearers here, except your righteousness, your obedience to the law of God exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you shall in no case enter into the kingdom. As I said earlier, that statement would have startled many in Jesus' audience. And it would have startled them because, as I've indicated already, many admired the scribes and the Pharisees, and they did so on account of their scrupulous observance of the law of God in all its aspects. But here, the very thing for which the scribes and the Pharisees were known and revered was being called into question by Jesus. The scribes and the Pharisees were regarded in Israel as perhaps the most outstanding and most religious of all people in the nation. Now, there was a Jewish proverb, in fact, that declared that if only two persons could enter into heaven, then one would be a scribe and the other would be a Pharisee. Therefore, it would have been difficult for those in Jesus' audience to have conceived of the possibility of anyone exceeding or surpassing the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. After all, the scribes were those who came from the tribe of Levi, and they had devoted their lives to the teaching and interpreting and expounding of the law of God. They were the acknowledged experts on the law of God. They were the authorities on the meaning and the requirements of the law. If anyone had a question about the law, they went to the scribes. And the scribes, more than anyone else, were those who were familiar with the law. They were consistently with that law. The task of producing new parchment copies of the law of God fell to them. And so given their familiarity with the law and the significant role that they performed in preserving it, the scribes were held in high regard by the Jews. The Pharisees likewise, though at times in some respects despised, were also held by many in high regard. And they were held in high regard also for their observance of the law of God, while they acknowledged for their outstanding observance of that law. Interestingly, the designation or the description Pharisee means literally separatist, and the Pharisees had obtained that designation or description because they had set themselves apart from others in the nation. The actual origins of the Pharisee or the sect of the Pharisees is not absolutely certain, but it's thought to have been, had come about during the intertestamentary period, when the Pharisees actually had sought to withstand the influence of the Greco-Roman world upon the Jews, and they sought to maintain the law of God against the intrusions of that worldliness that came from the Greco-Roman world. And so in that sense, they were revered as those that were, in a way, patriots in the nation of Israel. The Pharisees, of course, in their adoption or their approach to the law of God, observed the requirements of the law of God, but they also had a habit of adding to that law. And so you'll find, if you look into the methods and the ways of the Pharisees, that had established rules in addition to the law of God regarding washing. They had rules also about the food that could be eaten and the way that that food could be eaten. They had views also about the Sabbath, which were beyond what the law of God stipulated. You see, for example, something of that in that passage we read there in John 5 this morning about the incident at the Pool of Bethesda, where Jesus had enabled that man to be healed on the Sabbath day. And you find that the Jews at that time began to persecute Jesus because he had done these things on the Sabbath day. To do such a thing, to heal on the Sabbath day, according to the Pharisees, was a form of works, and so was prohibited according to their understanding on the Sabbath day. To grasp the import of what Jesus was teaching here and its application to ourselves, it's necessary to understand the character and the nature of the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. An insight into the character and mindset of both the scribes and the Pharisees can be gleaned by the parable of the Pharisee and the publican recorded in Luke 18 that we read this morning. You recall in that parable, the Pharisee had gone up to the temple to pray, and having done so, he stood forward in a very prominent place and thanked God that he was not like other men, and certainly not like the publican, that money-grubbing tax collector who he had observed standing afar off. And you recall that the Pharisee in that parable, in his pride and self-righteousness, trumpeted that he was not an extortioner, nor was unjust, nor was he an adulterer. Indeed, in his estimation, there was much that commended him to others. After all, he fasted twice a week when the law of God required a man to fast only once per year. He also gave a tithe or a tenth of all that he possessed, whereas the law required that he only tithe on his increase. And as illustrated by that parable, the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees was a righteousness intended to be seen by others. It was an external righteousness, a righteousness designed for public consumption. In other words, it was a righteousness that was designed to attract the attention and approval of others. The righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees consisted primarily in outward acts and in outward observance of the Lord. They emphasized the outward, the formal, but it was not a righteousness directed to the honour and glory of God, nor was it a righteousness actually motivated by a love for God. And furthermore, it was not a righteousness that arose from a work of God's grace in their hearts. It should be noted that Jesus did not criticise the scribes and the Pharisees here for their careful observance of the law. That was not the issue. The issue that Jesus had with the scribes and Pharisees was that their righteousness, their obedience, did not arise from hearts of love for God. Their righteousness did not spring from hearts that had been renewed and regenerated by the Spirit of God. Consequently, their righteousness was outward, it was formal, it was mechanical, it was self-centered. What drove the obedience of the scribes and Pharisees was external and carnal. It did not flow from hearts that had been softened and made willing and tender by the Spirit of God. And by focusing on the externals, the scribes and Pharisees actually avoided the real design of the law. The real design of the law being to draw them to Jesus Christ and to his grace and salvation. Dead Sea Scrolls refer to the Pharisees as, quote, seekers after smooth things, unquote. And it describes them that way because they accommodated and compromised the law to fit with their lives. In making such allowances, the scribes and Pharisees failed to grasp the need for the grace of God and their utter dependence upon him. Their righteousness, in truth, was a contrived righteousness, a righteousness designed for external consumption. And that's confirmed by what Jesus actually says concerning the scribes and the Pharisees. In Matthew 15, in verses 7 and 8, there you read, Jesus says of the scribes and Pharisees, he says, "Ye hypocrites, well did Isaiah prophesy of you, saying, this people draws near unto me with their mouth, and honours me with their lips, but notice this, their heart is far from me. The scribes and the Pharisees were careful to abstain from overtly sinful acts such as adultery, theft, murder, idolatry. But inwardly they were covetous, they were full of impure thoughts, hatred, bitterness, envy, and coldness of heart characterized many of the Pharisees. Recall what Jesus says of them also in Matthew 23, verses 25, 27, 28. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye make clean the outside of the cup and of the platter, but within they are full of extortion and excess. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye are like unto whited sepulchres, which indeed appear beautiful outward, but are within full of dead men's bones and of all uncleanness. Even so ye also outwardly appear righteous unto men. That's Jesus' description of the scribes and Pharisees. They outwardly appeared righteous unto men, but within, he says of them, ye are full of hypocrisy and iniquity. Furthermore, the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees was selective. They laid far more stress upon the detail of the law than they did upon the moral qualities that were an integral part of the keeping of the law of God. And it's for that reason you also find in Matthew 23, verses 23-24, that Jesus says this of them, Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. Jesus says this, these ought ye to have done, and not to leave the other undone. Ye blind guides, which strain at a gnat, and swallow a camel. See, the scribes and the Pharisees were precise to the nth degree in their observance of the detail of the law, the paying of the tithe or mint on anise and cumin. In other words, they tithe on the increase of even their herb gardens. Why? So that they might be acknowledged and lauded as scrupulous observers of the law. But there were things they neglected. And the things they neglected, says Jesus Christ, were the far more important matters that went to the very heart of the observance of the law of God. You see, they failed to manifest just judgment, nor did they actually show genuine mercy. Nor did their conduct flow out of a true and living faith. The truth was that the obedience of the scribes and the Pharisees was driven by improper self-seeking motives. They were motivated by self-interest rather than the honour and glory of God. They were quick to fast and they let others know of their great self-sacrifices. They prayed openly on the streets so they could be seen of men. They gave alms or they rendered assistance to others in such a way as those around them knew all about it. And all their actions were done with one fundamental motive in mind, namely their standing in the eyes of others. Their standing in the eyes of others is what motivated the scribes and the Pharisees. Jesus summed up the scribes and the Pharisees in the very first part of Matthew 23 in verses 5-7 when he said this, The scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. In other words, they were the teachers of the law as had been Moses. The scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. All therefore whatsoever they bid you observe, that observe and do. But then the Lord goes on to say, But do not ye after their works. Why does the Lord say that? He tells us, For they say and do not, but all their works they do for to be seen of men. They make broad their phylacteries, the phylacteries with the small leather pouches containing passages of scripture that used to hang around the waist of the Jews, reminding the Jews of their religious duties. And he says, they make broad their phylacteries and enlarge the borders of their garments, and they love the uppermost rooms at feasts, the chief seats in the synagogues, and greetings in the markets, and to be called of men, Rabbi, Rabbi, Teacher, Teacher. Despite all their outward activities and their apparent observance of the law, the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees was seriously lacking. Their righteousness was defective because it was merely external and did not arise from hearts renewed and spiritually enlivened by the Spirit of God. As you see that in the remainder, much of the remainder of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus' treatment of the moral law of God actually exposes the shortcomings of the scribes and the Pharisees. You know, brethren, today we may not describe others as scribes and Pharisees, and we may not even see ourselves as having tendencies toward the same things that attracted the scribes and Pharisees. But the truth is that the attitudes and the motivation of the scribes and the Pharisees is alive in the church world today. And I think if we're honest with ourselves, we'll also know that there's a measure of that in all of us. There's a sense in which we engage in the Christian life, not because of our love for God, not because of our love for the neighbour, not because of the fact that our hearts have been renewed by the Spirit of God. But at times we do so out of a sense of duty, out of a sense of wanting to be seen by others, out of a sense of a desire to have the approval and the plaudits of others. We can see that at times, I think, in just to give an illustration of that, why do we attend worship? Why are we here? Why are we here this morning? We're here because we love God. We love the Saviour. And we love the brethren. And we desire actually to worship God from the heart. Or are we at times like the scribes and the Pharisees? We go through the outward motions. We know we ought to be here. That's what Christians do on the Lord's Day. They attend worship. So we attend worship. But is the truth of the matter that our hearts are actually in it? We're actually worshipping God because we love him. Or is the truth of the matter, like the scribes and the Pharisees, that our hearts at times are actually far from him? And brethren, we can multiply those examples over and over again in our lives, so that in many instances, I think it's true to say that we actually go through the outward form of Christianity, but we actually are not engaged with the with Christianity from the heart. And the bad news, brethren, about that is this: if we don't engage with Christianity from the heart, what Jesus Christ is telling us here is it's a sham. It's not genuine. It's not real. It's a deception. Deception in a sense perpetrated upon men and women by Satan. And it's a deception in a certain sense that we perpetrate upon ourselves. So I think that deception is prevalent throughout the church world. And if we examine ourselves carefully, we will see indications of it in our own lives. The reality is that we're all actually attracted to the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. We're all prone to engage in a measure of external Christianity. We like to present an image. We know what to do. We actually know what to say. But too often what we do and what we say does not actually flow from hearts imbued with a love for God and a love for the neighbour. And so we engage in a form of hypocrisy. We're driven by a sense of duty, but not by a love for God or a love for the neighbour. Jesus says here, "Except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven." And that's sobering. So we need to understand, what does Jesus actually mean when he says, "Except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees"? Is he to be understood here as saying that the scribes and Pharisees had attained unto a certain level of righteousness, but that his hearers, that is you and I, must go beyond that level if we're actually to enter into the kingdom of heaven? Is that what's being said here? Scribes and Pharisees have got to a certain level of righteousness, but we just have to go a bit over and above that. So that in some measure, our obedience to the law of God has to be greater, has to be on a higher plane, has to be somehow superior, somehow more meritorious than that of the scribes and the Pharisees. Is Jesus here to be taken as indicating that the scribes and the Pharisees actually basically were going in the right direction, but simply had not gone far enough, and that to enter heaven we have to go that little bit further? But the truth is that that's not what Jesus is saying or indicating here at all. He's not giving approval in any way, shape or form to the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. The righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees was hypocrisy. It's not real. It was not genuine. What we need to understand here is that the superiority that Jesus speaks of here, the superiority required with respect to the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, was plainly one of kind, not of degree. The distinction here is that the superiority required with respect to the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees was one of kind, not of degree. In other words, what he's saying here is what we need is a fundamentally different kind of righteousness to the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees if we are to have a place in glory. You see, the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees was a false righteousness. It was a pseudo-righteousness. It was not the righteousness upon which entrance into the heaven, the kingdom of heaven, was or is grounded. A radically different kind of righteousness to that of the scribes and Pharisees is required if we are to enter into the kingdom of heaven. And that righteousness, the righteousness required to enter into the kingdom of heaven, is a righteousness that is rooted and grounded in the love of God. The righteousness required for entrance into the kingdom of heaven involves not only our external conduct, but it involves our hearts and minds. It's a righteousness that is first inward, vital, and spiritual. It's a righteousness born of the Spirit of God. It's the righteousness that is to be found and attained in and through a living relationship with Jesus Christ. The righteousness required of every citizen of the kingdom is one that conforms the whole of the believer's life to the law of God. Not only must our outward conduct and behaviour be in accordance with God's law, but that must also be the case with our inner thoughts, our attitudes, and our desires. And those inner thoughts and attitudes and desires are what will direct and dictate our actions. You see, brethren, our conduct will not be driven by duty or by the demands simply of the outward requirements of the law, but our conduct and our actions will actually be motivated by our love for God and, as a consequence, our love for our neighbour. That's what will drive our lives. That's what will shape our lives. What will shape our lives and our behaviour and our conduct will be the love of God, the first great commandment, and secondly, our love for the neighbour, the second great commandment of the law of God. As Jesus goes on in this same passage to explain, this will mean that we will not only refrain, for example, from killing our neighbour, that's the outward act, we won't simply murder our neighbour, but notice how the law of God arises from issues of the heart. In Jesus' explanation of that law, he tells us, in fact, that not only will we refrain from physically killing our neighbour, but we'll actually also refrain from being angry with him without a cause, and we will refrain from actually killing him in our hearts. And you can go on then also to look at how he deals with the subject of adultery in the subsequent verses as well. He tells us we'll refrain from the outward physical act of adultery. But it's not just the outward physical act that matters, it's what's in the heart. And so he tells us that we'll not only refrain from that physical act of adultery, but we'll also refrain from lusting after another man's or woman's husband or wife in our hearts. But only when our righteousness, only when our righteousness springs from hearts renewed by God's Spirit, from hearts that love God and the neighbour, will our righteousness exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. Their righteousness did not spring from a love of God and a love of the neighbour. Ours must, if we are to actually be those who will have a place in the kingdom of heaven. But then if we perceive that our righteousness does not exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, and as I've said, I think sometimes as we examine ourselves, we might rightly come to that conclusion. Or if indeed our perception is that our righteousness is in fact very similar to that of the scribes and the Pharisees, the question arises, how can we attain unto the righteousness of which Jesus Christ speaks here, that righteousness that will enable us to have a place in the kingdom of heaven? That surely is an essential and vital question for each and every one of us. Clearly we cannot attain unto such righteousness by personal endeavour. A righteousness that exceeds or excels the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees is not something that you or I can generate or conjure up within ourselves. Nor is it, for that matter, something that we can actually earn or even merit. Such righteousness is a gift of God. It stems from a work of God's sovereign grace in our hearts. In order for our righteousness to exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, we need to be made new creatures in Jesus Christ. Or to put it more simply, we need to be born again. We need to be renewed by the Spirit of God, and for the Spirit of God to actually reside and to live within our hearts. It's that new birth that produces the radical changes in us. It's that new birth that produces a love for God and a love for the neighbour. It's also what actually produces in us a love for the law of God. It's that work of God, for example, that enables us to come out of a love for God on the Lord's Day and to genuinely worship Him from the heart. As God says through the prophet Jeremiah, as a result of the inner working of the Spirit of God in the heart, "But this shall be the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith the Lord. I will put my law in their inward parts and write it in their hearts, and will be their God, and they shall be my people." That's what comes about as a result of the work of God's grace in our hearts. He puts His law into the inward parts, and He writes that law upon our hearts. That's why we love it. That's why we will follow it. And this comes about through the work of the regenerating, through the regenerating work of the Spirit of God, whereby we are miraculously and mystically united to Jesus Christ by His Spirit. And so as a result of that, that the law of God is written upon our hearts. And it's as a result of that that we are enabled to love God and to love the neighbour. Not perfectly. We don't do that perfectly in this life because of our remaining corruption. But that's our goal. That's our desire. That's what we are pursuing as Christians by God's grace. If you say, "I don't have that love of God, the love of the neighbour or the love of God's law in my heart," brethren, if you do not know of that righteousness that exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, but you desire it, take heart. Take heart. If you don't see it, but you desire it, take heart, because that desire is actually the work of the Spirit of God. What should you do in such circumstances? Well, what if you know something of that righteousness that exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees? You desire a greater measure of it. And that, I suspect, brethren, is all of us. What can we do? We can do this. We can get down on our knees. And we can plead with the Lord that He might grant us a greater measure of that grace that we stand in need of, in order that we might be those who exhibit that righteousness that exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. Who of us can't do that? Who of us can't actually get down on our knees and actually plead with the Lord that He might grant to us that very thing that we lack? Brethren, use the means of grace. Pray. Pray, "Lord, give me that righteousness. Send your Spirit into your heart. Change my heart. Renew me. Enliven me. Grant me a greater measure of your Spirit. Make me to be spiritually alive. Grant unto me that spiritual sensibility that at times I lack. Give me a love for yourself, a love for the neighbour, a love for your law, and let that love shine forth every day in my life. Brethren, a righteousness that exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees is absolutely necessary if you or I would enter into the kingdom of heaven. That's what our text says here. For I say unto you, who's speaking? Jesus Christ is speaking. It's Jesus Christ who says, except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. Who's Jesus Christ? Well, of course, he's the Son of God, second person of the Trinity. But also significantly, he is the King. He's the King of the kingdom. And this is his word. And it's an emphatic word. Except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. And Jesus here is speaking in the strongest possible terms. Those words translated, you shall in no case, mean literally, you shall of an absolute certainty. You shall of an absolute certainty not enter into the kingdom of heaven unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. Unless you have a different righteousness to the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. Beloved in Jesus Christ, what's the nature of your righteousness? That's a question I need to ask myself. What's the nature of my righteousness? What motivates your obedience to the law of God? What motivates my obedience to the law of God? When we actually, for example, show kindness to someone else, to a brother or sister in the church, what actually motivates you? Is it the praise of others? Is it because you feel simply obliged to do so? Is it because you like to be stroked and acknowledged by others? I'm not saying at times that the Lord does not hedge us about. Sometimes the Lord hedges us about for our own good. For example, he says, remember the Sabbath day. And we ought not to simply think, well, I don't really love the Lord. I don't really love the brethren. I won't attend worship. That would be a mistake. The Lord hedges us about. But it doesn't mean that simply to attend worship on the basis of outward conformity is all that's required. And these are obviously deeply personal matters, the truth of which can actually be only known by ourselves. These are actually matters as between ourselves and the Lord. But these are absolutely vital matters. By God's grace and through the work of his Spirit, may it be that our righteousness does exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. Because the glorious news is that if we are endowed with that righteousness that arises from a living faith in Jesus Christ, there is a place for us, an assured place for us in the kingdom of heaven. Amen. Let's stand for a brief word of